There we go. Teleology, design in the universe, an argument for God's existence. So, just the whole, it goes further back, this whole concept of design. But around 387 BC, there was a famous man by the name of Plato. Plato purchased a house in a park known as Academica, just outside of Athens, and he opened up a school that would last for almost 900 years. That school was in place 387 BC all the way up to AD 529. And the only reason why Plato's school was forced to close many generations after Plato died was that the Byzantine emperor shut it down. Plato's goal, his stated goal, was the search for truth by the means of rational inquiry. Look for truth through the mind. And so according to Plato, there are two things that lead men to believe in God. The argument from the existence of the soul, said we all have souls, so we have to have something that we came from, and the argument from the order of the motion of the stars and all the things under the dominion of the mind, which ordered the universe. And this comes from his book, Laws. We have a reference there. Plato had to use these arguments basically to refute the atheism of his day. And the atheism's a bit different than what we understand it. They had a whole bunch of gods within the Greek and Roman pantheon. Atheism basically meant that you didn't have anything to do with the Greek and Roman gods. Not that you didn't necessarily have a god, but you didn't have anything to do with the Greek and Roman gods. And so he used these arguments to refute atheism and concluded that there must be a best soul. Kind of like the ultimate soul. If we were to paint a picture of the most pure, most profound, most all-encompassing being, it would be this best soul who is the maker and father of all, the king, who ordered the primordial chaos into the rational cosmos that we observe today. So Plato was somebody that stood for design. And his academy that he has instituted outside of Athens for 900 years stood for that as well. The observation that the universe was orderly and well-designed gave birth to something known as the scientific method. Before Plato and his contemporaries and a few other men came onto the scene, it was believed that things just happened randomly. You know, there's no good reason for why the sun comes up today. Perhaps tomorrow it won't. And so they believed that the world was kind of ordered by chaos. But when Plato came around, and Plato really influences Western thought and says there is a divine mind that has created order out in the universe. In other words, things are predictable. Things are repeatable. That's a big deal. And this whole thing, as simple as it sounds, gave birth to the modern scientific method. Basically, it means we can repeat our observations and experiments, and we can anticipate that if something changes, it changes for a reason. In other words, the variables have changed. Something that feeds into it has changed, rather than just changing randomly as a result of everything being chaotic. And we discussed this before, but the scientific method centers around you create a hypothesis. A hypothesis is something that's testable. It's something that you will test over and over and over again, and you're attempting to prove it false. If you have something that you cannot prove false, it's not a hypothesis. There, guess what? Darwinian evolution is in what category? And I'll give you all the categories, and I'll ask that question again. Hypothesis, you have to be able to prove that it's false. You have to be able to test it to even have a hypothesis. If the hypothesis gets tested over and over and over again, and you come up with the same results every single time, and you understand all the variables and everything that went into that, that becomes a theory. In other words, it's a level above hypothesis, and if that theory is proven true over decades, that becomes a law. And the laws are like gravity, you know, those kinds of things. Laws, constants that we know are the same everywhere. Can't get away from them in this universe. Where is Darwinian evolution on this scale? Hypothesis, theory, or law? What's that? April's a genius.
What?
April is the genius in the room this evening. April says none of these, Darwinian evolution is not testable. Matter of fact, it's not falsifiable. It just changes every time. So while they call it the theory of evolution, they're using the wrong term according to the scientific method, it isn't really, we can argue, it isn't even a good hypothesis. It's not testable. You can't falsify it. What, can you go back and retest history? No. And this goes back to, we've discussed before in some of our sessions, there are limits to what science can do. There are real limits to what science can tell us about this world. And science is limited to testable hypotheses, which if tested and over again become theories. And if those theories stand true for generations, they become laws. This is what science is all about. So this whole understanding of the universe being ordered, that there was a divine mind behind all of it, and granted, everybody thought that that divine mind was somebody else, but being that there's a grand mind behind of it, there, you can predict outcomes. It's not just all random and chaotic. For a very long time, the scientific method bore fruit. You know, we have some of the greatest Christians, some of the greatest scientists were Christians, and vice versa. And they did it based upon a predictable universe that had been governed and created by an orderly and rational God. But then modern thought took a big bender. Right? Modern thought embraced Darwinian evolution, embraced it in all of its entailments. And that meant that now it's just chaos. You popped into existence, you were belched forth from chaos. And you're going to be consumed by chaos once again someday, especially if you believe in the Big Bang, Big Crunch theory, where you have universe expanding, reaching its limits, and then crunching back down and collapsing, and then expanding again and crunching again. You just basically are a product of chance and chaos. And scientists used to think, based off of modern theory that comes after Darwinian evolution, that whatever the very early universe might have been like, given sufficient time and some luck, intelligent life forms like ourselves would eventually evolve somewhere. It just has to happen. And as a result of discoveries over the last 40 years or so, we now know that that assumption was wrong. In fact, the very opposite is true. It's very much the opposite is true. And it's all because of this thing called fine-tuning. And it's been noticed by everybody. It's not just the Christians. It's not just the theists that have noticed fine-tuning. The atheists have noticed it as well. And they have to have some way of explaining why it exists. So what is fine-tuning? Fine-tuning means that there's a very narrow band of values that the forces in our universe can have in order to sustain life. Very narrow band of values. And we're going to look at a few examples of these in a few moments. If these forces and variables vary by even the smallest of margins, life would not be possible anywhere in the universe. Matter of fact, matter couldn't even exist as we know it. That's pretty stunning. We'll look at some of this and some of the ramifications of it. But fine-tuning is seen everywhere, and it's acknowledged not only by the theists, but also by the atheists. Fine-tuning. So here's an example. The electromagnetic coupling constant, that's actually a term, the electromagnetic coupling constant, binds electrons to protons and atoms. This is one way to conceptualize it. We know that atoms aren't exactly a particle or a wave. They have properties of both. There's an awful lot that we just don't know about atoms. But you can picture an atom as if it was a mini-universe with electrons orbiting around a nucleus of protons and neutrons. In order for that to work, it has to be a lot like the planets in the solar system that we have today. You have to have very specific gravity so that you keep your orbit, right? As the moon goes around the Earth, there has to be very specific proportions to set it into an orbit that gets sustained, that doesn't collapse or doesn't go winging off into space. And that's based on the relative mass of the Earth to the moon and vice versa. The same thing exists at the subatomic level. Exists down at the atoms level. There is a electromagnetic coupling that consists based off of the ratio of the protons to the neutrons and the electrons as far as their mass and their size. If this electromagnetic coupling constant was smaller, fewer electrons could be held. Well, what happens if all of your electrons go spinning off? What will happen? What's that?
Imbalance,
but even worse, disintegration. You want to see everything just kind of dissolve into an icky ooh. That would it be because the electrons couldn't hold together, right? They just spin off into space. If it's too strong, now that you know what I've put on the slide, if the binding is too strong, those electrons can't leave their orbits. And guess what? You have no chemical reactions. Because chemical reactions are driven by electrons and other things within the nucleus of the atom. You have, if you can't have any chemical reactions, you have no biochemistry. And if that's true, you have no life. And this only has to change. It's a very infinitesimally small force, this electromagnetic coupling constant. They have an actual number for it. But if it varies even slightly, life does not exist at all. Not at all. Another example of fine tuning. Our sun is the right color. Doesn't seem like too big of a deal, you know. The sun color. I don't care if you're blue, orange, or red. You know, that kind of thing. If it was more rude or more red or more blue, photosynthetic response would be weaker or nearly non-existent. A specific amount of energy is needed for the process to work properly. So I'm not going to bore you with everything that happens within photosynthesis, but some of you remember biology back there. I remember it from high school where I first was introduced to this. But basically, sunlight comes down, and when it hits these little green things known as chloroplasts, these are little factories. And there's some things that happen there. And I'll read you this, and then I'll explain it. When photons strike electrons within a cluster of molecules known as a photosystem, they leave their ground state, reaching a higher level of energy. And this energy is used to split water, releasing electrons, protons, and oxygen, which is released into the environment. So what happens basically is you have water coming in. In order to break the hydrogen away from the oxygen and water, you need energy. And what happens in that chloroplast is it takes that energy from the sun and uses that energy in order to split the molecule of water apart. And when that happens, you have carbon dioxide and oxygen that come in. You have the sun's energy acting upon the chloroplast, the little energy factories within here, and they release C6H12O6, more commonly known as sugar, and it produces as a byproduct something that you need to survive, oxygen. So, the whole thing here is, if the wavelength of red and blue sunlight and orangish sunlight, it's different amounts of energy. It's a different, literally a different wavelength. And if that wavelength varies, then those little chloroplasts can't do their job. It'll either do it too much, which there's ramifications to too much, or too little. And once again, you don't end up with life. It's fine-tuned. And this is one of the things that puzzles us. How does it get exactly the right amount of energy based upon the sun? It's one of the complexities of life. Another example of fine-tuning. Our sun is the right mass. If it was larger, there would be too much light energy radiation, which would destroy living cells. Radiation operates on a wavelength. You get bombarded too much, it actually destroys cells. You just can't have life. So the sun's the right mass in order to give us warmth, produce some vitamin A or whatever it is, but it doesn't kill us. Isn't that nice? If the sun's mass was smaller, the range of planetary distances able to support life would be too narrow. The right distance would be so close to the star that tidal forces would disrupt the planet's rotational period. Not to mention probably just suck it right down into the sun and we'd all have a burning death. You know, those kind of things. Also, even before the burning death, the tides are going to be so huge, they're going to cross continents and we're all going to drown. So die, you're going to drown first, then you're going to burn. Isn't that encouraging if the sun was smaller in mass? And that doesn't have to vary by that much. Doesn't have to vary by that much at all. If the Earth also was smaller, UV radiation would also be inadequate for photosynthesis, which takes us back to the prior slide. Recap that argument. The Earth's distance from the sun is crucial for a stable water cycle. Too far away, and most of the water would freeze, as it does out here on Pluto. If there were water on Pluto, we have no idea. And too close, you get into Mars and those kind of things, it's all just going to boil away. No way that you can have life. And water, as we all know, is essential for life. And some have substituted coffee in the whole grand cycle of things. Coffee is necessary for life. Another example of fine-tuning is the Earth's magnetic field is just right so that we don't become crispy critters. And so we have a tilt of 11.5 degrees on the axis here that establishes our magnetic pole. These are magnetic rings surrounding the Earth. We don't even know what fuels it. The theory is that there is an iron core of molten metal within the middle of the Earth, because it gets increasingly hotter as you go down, burning hot in the middle of the Earth. And that iron core, because it's turning and stuff, creates this massive electromagnetic field. That's the theory. We have no idea. But we do know that the sun, there's such raging billows and storms and stuff constantly coming off the sun. If this magnetic energy blanket wasn't there, we would get those direct rays, and you would burn up pretty quick, if not just have cancer and die. There's no really nice alternative here. And so this whole fine-tuning of the magnetic field is just right. Just right, so that life can exist here, and we're not on another planet getting bombarded to death by the sun. You think about all those things that are in balance at this point just from the sun. How does that happen? That's a massive amount of fine-tuning. Here's another example of irreducible complexity and fine-tuning. What irreducible complexity means, well, first step back. There's a guy named Michael Behe. He's part of what's called the intelligent design movement. Michael Behe wrote a stellar book, which I read probably almost a decade and a half ago, called Darwin's Black Box. And in Darwin's Black Box, Michael Behe, he says, there are certain things, like mouse traps, that are pretty much irreducibly complex. In other words, you can't really remove one of the parts without making it useless. So in the mouse trap, you have a hammer, you have a catch, you have the spring, you have the platform itself and the holding bar. You might be able to play with those dimensions, but you can't remove any one of these parts and still have a working mouse trap. It's irreducibly complex. Well, that's interesting, because there's a lot of things in nature that are also irreducibly complex. You remove one component of it and it's useless. It doesn't serve any purpose. Evolution states that a creature survives, survival of the fittest, by having beneficial mutations. You know, the mutations are what are supposedly driving evolution forward. If a mutation is not beneficial, in other words, you all of a sudden grow a third leg, it actually isn't beneficial, it leads to death. Well, I just said that, that's tautologist. But if you have like a third leg, that actually hampers you when the lion's chasing you down the road. You're probably going to trip and fall and the thing's going to eat you, right? There are certain mutations that aren't beneficial. Matter of fact, we haven't really cataloged any beneficial mutations. Some have gone down to like the bacteria level, and they say these bacteria have mutated so now that they no longer respond to poison within the system. The problem is, in order to not respond to that poison and die, they're missing something. They're actually missing information in their genetic code. There was no addition, there was no mutation that actually created something. There's actually something missing, and they're overproducing a certain substance which makes them immune to the poison. That's the only examples that we found. We haven't found any truly beneficial mutations. We've certainly not seen a dog all of a sudden start flying. We've never seen those kind of things happen. But these beneficial mutations supposedly would have to happen like this. You get an eyelash without an eyeball, right? How about a tear duct without an eyeball? How about the cone inside the eyeball without the eyeball? How about you get a complete eyeball, but it's not attached to the brain? How about you get the lens and the cone, but not the rest of it? You can't, it's irreducibly complex. If not all of it's there, including the tear duct, the eyeball's useless. And matter of fact, the eyeball is not beneficial. It would actually be detrimental to have just one portion of it. What good's an eyelash? At the end of the day, by itself, nothing. And so what Michael Behe was pointing out is this is irreducibly complex. Everything has to exist all at once in order to give any benefit in natural selection. And that has some big ramifications for how we understand the world. It really does point at a designer. It really does point that somebody had to put all these things together because they didn't incrementally show up. There's no sense, rhyme, or reason to that. And it took the information age, coming into the age of computers and understanding data and how things get created and through intellect, to start really digging into this whole thing of fine-tuning and irreducible complexity.
Is there anything that is not irreducibly complex?
It'd be pretty hard to find. It really would. You start arguing enough. But the hypothesis has been, you know, oh, it can come along incrementally. How? You've really got to surmount that. The big one for me is, how do you get reproduction? That's huge. You don't have a launching pad at that point. Yeah.
I know that, you know, you talked about incrementally, and that's what they'll say. So if you had parts of the eye, they would say that...
They would have to find some reason why that part had some kind of benefit to the species,
yeah,
and gave it survivability above and beyond its peers. And you just can't find it. I mean, eyelash, tear duct. Which one of these came first? This also goes back to the chicken and egg argument, oddly enough. You know, which one are you going to bring forward first? And we've got to kick it around quite a bit. And you don't, at the end of the day, you don't come up with anything that gives benefit for survivability. Matter of fact, all of these incremental things actually makes it detrimental for your survival, right? What's good to have a foot without toes? It's just something to trip on as you try to escape the predator. On and on and on. We could go through these kind of things. But it gets pretty bizarre. Any other questions? Because I've been talking for a while now. Or any other points? Oh. Yeah, Adam, did you have something? No, okay. Yeah, I didn't know that was it was just a nervous twitch. Oh, he was already on the slide. Fine-tuning. A few more examples out of a universe of potential examples. From galaxies to stars down to atoms and subatomic particles, the very structure of our universe is determined by these numbers. If they change, life can't exist. For example, the speed of light, 299,792,458 miles per second. The gravitational constant, as we understand it, that fits into planetary mass and the effect of tides, and we go on and on and on. Planck's constant, Planck mass energy, the mass of the electron, proton, and neutron that we talked about, those have to be in very specific ratios just to hold atoms together, much less form molecules. The mass of up-down strange quark, I have no idea, don't ask me about that one. The ratio of electron to proton mass, kind of covered in the previous one. Gravitational coupling constant, we've talked about. The cosmological constant, the Hubble constant, the Higgs vacuum expectation value. That some of these have to do with some of the things we observe in the universe. The universe is expanding. There's a redshift. We talked about that last week. Do I need to re-explain redshift? We won't do it now. I can explain it for anybody that wants to know about it. But these are the fundamental constants and quantities of the universe. And scientists have come to the shocking realization that each of these numbers have been carefully dialed to an astonishingly precise value. A value that falls within an exceedingly narrow and life-permitting range. And if any of these numbers were altered by even a hair's breadth, no physical interactive life of any kind could exist anywhere. There'd be no stars, no life, no planets, no chemistry. And hopefully, as you looked at some of the fine-tuning things, some of the other examples I gave, you change one of them, it impacts all the other aspects of fine-tuning. So they're interrelated. They're finely tuned by themselves, and then they're interrelated to all the other aspects of fine-tuning. So intermeshed, it gets truly mind-numbing to try to calculate some probability of life existing at all. Of existing at all. Paul?
Just go back to that redshift, because I wasn't here last week. Redshift, and doesn't that tie in also with blue shift? And didn't scientists also find out that because of those two things, I don't know exactly how it works, but they actually found out that Earth is near to the center of the universe?
There's many that have postulated that, because we observe far more redshift than blue shift. I mean, it's astronomically different. We only see a few things. Blue shift indicates that an object is moving towards you. I can explain this real fast. The whole redshift, blue shift, it's a matter of perspective. So here is Owen. If you ever listen to a siren, a police siren, what does it sound like as it coming towards you? It's higher pitched, isn't it? What does it sound like as it goes away from you? It's lower pitched. Because
the Doppler effect.
Yeah, sound is waves. As something comes towards you, those waves are compressed, higher pitched. As it goes away from your perspective, those waves get very long, and that becomes lower pitched. Light is also a wave. Light is one of those crazy things that has both characteristics of particles and of waves. And so light at the lower end, if it's being compressed, if it's coming towards you, you would see blue light. If it's going away from you, you would see red light. And as has been observed in one of our arguments that we gave for the existence of God last week, the universe had to have a beginning because it seems to be originating from a centralized point. We did not say Big Bang, just to put that in a constant. But what is being observed in the universe was by Hubble's telescope when it first got out there into space, and we even before that, Hubble observed this, that there is a redshift occurring for almost every object that we can see in the universe. It's moving outwards, which also would seem to indicate we might be somewhere near the center, and whatever ramifications that might have. I may be able to opine later on those. But that is pretty much what redshift is, and it's one of, it fits into the arguments for existence. If I think about it long enough, I can figure out how it perfectly ties into the fine-tuning. Fine-tuning. So what does this mean? You're alive. What are the odds? The proper analogy, and I'm going to read this, for a universe that is fine-tuned to promote life would be a lottery in which billions and billions of white balls are mixed together with one black ball. And you are told that unless the black ball is pulled, you're going to be shot and killed. But then, lo and behold, a random ball is picked and it turns out to be the black one. And you're allowed to live. You ought to think that the lottery was rigged. And why is that? Not because the black ball is any more improbable than any other particular white ball. Each ball is equally improbable. But because it is overwhelmingly, incomprehensibly more probable that whichever ball is picked, it will be white rather than black. Similarly, our universe is no more improbable than any other universe, but it is overwhelmingly more probable that whichever universe exists, it will be life prohibiting rather than life permitting. And we still need some sort of explanation as to why a life-permitting universe exists at all, against all probability to the contrary. Why is this universe fine-tuned for life? Why are all these values at just the right settings? They could be just a little bit different. Why are they the way they are? We didn't just win the improbable lottery outcome once. We've won it over and over and over and over again. You think about every stage. You go back, what's the probability of an amoeba? What's the probability of a molecule? What's the probability? You go through everything, and it's just horribly improbable for any of those things to happen. You keep on building those on top of each other. We've won the cosmic lottery billions and billions and billions of times over. So fine-tuning. You might be surprised to see that fine-tuning is generally recognized by atheists. They say, yes, life is fine-tuned. They agree to that now. Matter of fact, fine-tuning has driven much of modern physics. And I'll explain that as well. Wherever physicists look, they see examples of fine-tuning. Sir Martin Rees. Rees is an atheist. he was the British Royal Society of Science, the head of that for many years. He won the Templeton Prize for some of the work that he did, but he's still not a believer. Templeton Prize is $1 million given to somebody that impacts spirituality, and they think some of his work contributed to that. The next quote, Stephen Hawking, who is trying to figure out how everything is interconnected and the meaning of everything, had a movie just made about him. He said, the remarkable fact is that the value of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. He cedes the argument here. He says it's all fine-tuned. David Deutsch, who's no friend of creationists, much less Christian, says, if anyone claims not to be surprised by the special features the universe has, he is hiding his head in the sand. These special features are surprising and unlikely. And then we can go to Sir Frederick Hoyle, a little bit more of a friend. Hoyle has talked about how the improbability of the universe is just so stratospheric, just totally improbable. He's done a lot of work here. He says, a common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect monkeyed with physics, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seems to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. And then we have Paul Davies, who's also an atheist, there is, for me, powerful evidence that there is something going on behind it all. It seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming. These are some massive minds. And no doubt, these are the conclusions they should draw. After all, Psalm 19, 1 through 2, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. You know, these guys are sitting in these laboratories, and they are peering into the heavens, and they're looking at the smallest imaginable levels, and they're seeing unbelievable complexity, and they're seeing this fine-tuning, and often you'll hear, you see them write about in awe of the things that they're discovering, and talk about how science is just an amazing life's work, totally worthy of them committing the long hours and spending an entire lifetime dedicated towards it. They're really taken with it, and because they're entranced by the beauty that God's created. But nature is pouring forth speech, and the question becomes, are they really listening to what it's saying? They've listened to a portion of it. They say the universe is fine-tuned. But unfortunately, none of these guys go running into the open arms of God. Not a single one of them. It says this in Romans 1:18 through 21. I just repeated it. It's almost cliche for us. But the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. That's what's happening. They acknowledge a portion of the truth. The universe is fine-tuned. And as we're going to see, they're doing gymnastics to get out of it. We'll see some of the gymnastics. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. He has shown it to them. The universe is fine-tuned, so where do you go? For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. That very much is happening. So there are arguments against fine-tuning. They acknowledge it in one breath. They'll even say this seems to demand that somebody's monkeying around with these numbers. They're just too finely tuned, and there's too many of them. And just one of them has to be wrong, and no life exists in the entire universe. Okay? So here's one argument. We should not be surprised by a life-permitting universe because that is the only one we can observe. That is a common argument. It doesn't sound like much, but they're saying, well, of course you can observe it. You're here. It's a little silly when you really think about it. We'll explore it with an illustration. To sum up the counterargument, imagine you're traveling abroad and arrested on trumped-up drug charges. You're dragged in front of a firing squad of 100 trained marksmen standing at point-blank range. They're right on top of you. You hear the command given, ready, aim, fire. You hear the deafening sound of the guns, and then you observe that you're still alive, that all the 100 marksmen missed. Now, what would you conclude? And this is the conclusion that they're really giving. They'll say, well, I guess I shouldn't be surprised that they all missed. After all, if they hadn't at all missed, I wouldn't be here to be surprised about it. Nothing more to be explained here. That's basically what they're saying. They all missed, and I'm here to observe it, and I'm not surprised. Let's just move on here. The response that we should have to this, and believe it or not, this is a response you often get. It's true that you shouldn't be surprised that you don't observe that you're dead, since if you were dead, you wouldn't be able to observe it. Tautology all over the place here. But you should still be surprised that you do deserve that you're alive, in light of the enormous improbability that all the marksmen would miss. Indeed, you'd probably conclude that they all missed on purpose, that the whole thing was a setup engineered for some reason by someone. There's design there. There's an intent. There's an intellect behind that kind of thing happening. And here's a picture of a guy who survives after the 100 marksmen take a shot at him. They shouldn't have missed. Why did they? Is the question that should be ever present in our minds. So that's one argument. I think it's rather easily handled. This argument is a little bit different. So they are so desperate to avoid this idea of fine-tuning that they have created the theory of the multiverse. You ever wonder why you watch the Discovery Channel and you see, oh, we have bubble universes and there may be parallel universes to ours, and they come up with all these explanations? Because they're responding to the fine-tuning argument. They have to find a way, how does this universe that we live in support and sustain life? And they'll say, well, it's one of billions of universes. And we're here to observe it because we're alive in it, right? And if we had been in any of the other universes, we wouldn't be able to observe it. So if I can create enough universes, life then becomes profitable in at least one universe. We're the one black ball out of billions of white balls, folks, is what they've done. So because they see the universe so fine-tuned, they had to create billions of others where life doesn't exist. That's the whole reason. Sounds kind of silly, doesn't it? But at the end of the day, that's how far a mind set against God will go to avoid the truth. And this theory isn't held by some chump down the road here, okay? This theory is held by the brightest atheistic minds in science. The summation of their counterargument. According to this hypothesis, our universe is but one member of a world ensemble or multiverse of randomly ordered universes, preferably infinite in number. They really want an infinite number of universes. If all of these other universes really exist, then by chance alone, life-permitting worlds will appear somewhere within the world ensemble. Since only finely tuned universes have observers in them, any observers existing in the world ensemble will naturally observe their worlds to be finely tuned. So no appeal to design is necessary to explain fine tuning. It is just merely pure chance. You buy that argument? Would we ever have imagined looking for infinite universes if we weren't trying to escape the idea of a designer? No. So our response: if you deal the cards enough times, eventually every hand will come up, is one of the things they also argue. The very fact that otherwise sober scientists must resort to such a remarkable hypothesis is a backhanded compliment to the hypothesis of design. It shows that fine-tuning does cry out for an explanation. So I think we respond that way. You had to go to great lengths. You had to create an infinite number of other universes to explain why this one happens to be fine-tuned. Would you have ever gone to those lengths unless you were trying to escape from a designer? I think that's the response back. One way to respond to the many worlds hypothesis would be to show that the multiverse itself also involves fine-tuning. You can't get away from it. What caused all the infinite number of universes to exist has to then become the question. For in order to be scientifically credible, some plausible mechanism must be suggested for generating the many worlds. But if the many worlds hypothesis to be successful in attributing fine-tuning to chance alone, then the mechanism that generates the many worlds had better not be fine-tuned itself. This merely delays the problem. It really does. So if they say, we're the improbable universe among an infinite number of universes. All the other ones can't support life, but we just so happen to be lucky enough we're in this one. No reason for design. We say, but what created all the other multiverses? What made that possibility come into being? Many scientists are so skeptical of this mini-universe hypothesis. I think we need to make that point. It seems to be merely an escape mechanism to resolve fine-tuning. In the end, I think it's a coping mechanism or it's an escape mechanism. And you'll see these all over science. To escape from the idea that God is out there, they go to incredible lengths. And that's all this is. Even though they have gone into great depths trying to explain mathematically how this could work. It's kind of funny. You got a guy like Stephen Hawking who can't move, confined to a wheelchair for all of his life. He has a massive amount of intellect, and all of it is spent churning away at a problem that doesn't need to exist. What would happen if he actually applied himself to the real problems of this world? It'd be amazing. But instead, the God of delusion has got him wrapped into an enigma and a puzzle with no answer. It's very sad. Another response to the argument of multiverses is even these alternate universes must have had a beginning, which means that you should peek at last week's slide deck for the arguments from Leibniz and Al-Ghazali's arguments. They're really kind of incredible. They're airtight arguments for the existence of God, and they make an extremely strong case. And if you don't have it, get the slide deck or those kind of things. I'm not going to go back through them because those were pretty involved to lay out. Simple points, but want to lay out all the counter-arguments as well. So here's another argument against design. Before we do that, do you have any other arguments against design? Can you think of anything? Not necessarily that I'm going to be able to answer or give a counter to it, but what other arguments do you know against design? Take a stab. We need boldness. April was bold. April gave an answer. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to objectify it.
He's too thorough.
We
just can't think of
it. Yeah. What I got is a bunch of chickens, is what I got. I feel like I should be getting my feed bag out or something. Now, you guys, I know you're all thinking deeply and furiously within your heads, and you probably have something out there. But I won't do to you what Professor Gromacki at Cedarville told me to do to wait him out. He'd wait 20 minutes. That's just too long. Too awkward. If you think of something, you have something?
No.
No, you're just still balking. Okay.
It's like, wow.
Yeah. So, Dawkins. Dawkins wrote a book called God Delusion, and he decided he wanted to deal with this fine-tuning argument once and for all. So he trotted out his own. He has if you follow the argument through his book, he has a whole bunch of premises and a conclusion that he draws from it. And so we're going to lay out his premises. What are they? One of the greatest challenges to the human intellect has been to explain how the complex, improbable appearance of design in the universe arises. What has he just recognized? There's the appearance of design. How do I get around it? The natural temptation is to attribute the appearance of design to actual design itself. Oh, wait for it. 3, the temptation is a false one because the designer hypothesis immediately raises the larger problem of who designed the designer. And if you go back to Leibniz's argument from last week, there's necessarily existing kinds of things and things that have to be causal. And I don't want to dive back down into that. I think there's other weak points in this argument we can attack. So, 4, the most ingenious and powerful explanation is Darwinian evolution by natural selection. That's the best answer, he thinks. So he's just saying this seems to be the most probable one. We don't have an equivalent explanation for physics. We should not give up hope of a better explanation arising in physics. Something as powerful as Darwinism is for biology. And then his conclusion, therefore, God almost certainly does not exist. So before we go to the next slide, tell me where the weaknesses are. Which one would you attack? Because all you have to do is prove one of the premises wrong to refute the conclusion, if this is a well-formed argument. Right? You also have to evaluate, do his premises necessarily and irrefutably lead to that conclusion if we granted they were all true? Right? That's all the whole thing of logic. Your premises have to add up in the end. And so you have to evaluate that. And then I'd ask you, which one of these would you attack? And this I will wait a little bit for, because I think this is worthwhile even before we get to the next slide. He's made the good confession.
It says design. You hear on the History Channel all the time. Look at the beautiful design and intricacy.
Yeah, capitalized nature time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Deify nature.
Design all the time, yet they never...
Yeah.
We just laugh at it, because...
But then he goes on and says, it may appear to be designed, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. Which one of these would you attack? Yeah.
Well, I mean, to me it seems that even his points don't... prove, even if all those things were true, it doesn't prove that God doesn't exist.
Well done. That is very true. Nope, that is exactly the case, as we'll see on the next slide. These premises, even if we grant that every single one of them is true, they do not necessarily lead to this. They don't have to go there. Even if you grant all of this is true. Anything else? Would you attack anyone in particular? No right or wrong answer to this. Because there's many different ways to attack this. This is really a weak argument. It's not nearly as good as a Leibniz or a Al-Ghazali. Yeah, either one of you.
What I was going to say was, like, even if you granted Darwinian evolution, that does not eliminate God. No, I'm not taking sides.
No, I understand where you're going. You're absolutely right there as well.
What I just said, but on that point.
Yeah. Yeah, and while we don't, as a church, we don't agree with old world design, even if we granted Darwinian evolution, it doesn't erase the need for a God out of this equation.
You still have the law of conservation of mass and matter or mass and energy says that. Matter can't be created or destroyed. Energy can't be created or destroyed. Mm-hmm. You still have matter and energy. Where did they come from if all our laws say they can't exist apart? I mean, they can't be created or destroyed. Where'd they come from then?
Yeah, you end up with infinite matter. And if you, the problem with it, there's a lot of problems with infinite matter, as we discussed last week. You can't really arrive there. You just can't.
Mr. Kent Oven said once that he was a debating atheist, and he said that basically you have an infinite regress where something has existed forever. He said, so I believe in the beginning God, you believe in the beginning dirt. You know, you had matter, I know. Now he sounds like a fool.
Yeah. Have to deify something at the end of the day. And it certainly, we talked about some of the cause and effect a little bit last week, but you have to, how do you get from a cause sufficient enough for intellect, mind, emotion, and will? Those are kind of hard things to get around to. Well, if there's no other interjections, we'll move into this. Some observations about Dawkins' argument. As you noted, it is no way necessary to arrive at Dawkins' conclusion even if we grant all of his points. It does not logically follow. At most, if we grant him all of his premises, all that follows from Dawkins' argument is that we should not infer God's existence on the basis of the appearance of design in the universe. That's all of his argument says. If we grant him every point, if we say these are all true, which we don't, we really don't. But one of the ways you can test somebody's argument, just grant all their points and see if it really adds up, or what it does it add up to. In this case, it doesn't add up to the idea that God doesn't exist, but that conclusion is the conclusion you do come to is quite compatible with God's existence, and even with our justifiably believing in God's existence. Even if we grant everything that Dawkins said is true, we're still justified in believing in the existence of God. He doesn't do anything to that argument. Maybe we should believe in God on the basis of the cosmological argument. Maybe we should believe in God on the basis of the moral argument. Maybe our belief in God isn't based on arguments at all, but it's grounded in religious experience or on divine revelation. The point is that rejecting design arguments for God's existence does nothing to prove that atheism is true or that belief in God is unjustified. I think we can make a case from design that there is a God. But even if we grant him all of his arguments against it and how he's constructed this, it does nothing to our argument. God exists. It doesn't even tie into it. So, here's the argument again, giving the points. Step number 5 refers to the cosmic fine-tuning that has been the focus of our discussion. We don't have an equivalent explanation for physics. I want to explain what that means. I kind of didn't do it earlier. There is no evolutionary explanation out there for the fine-tuning of physics. They'll talk about how the human body's been fine-tuned, and they'll try to throw evolution in there to explain how we got to the way we are, you know, the current state of things. But there is no equivalent within the realm of physics, no evolutionary kind of thing in physics that can explain the fine-tuning that we see. It totally falls short. So we need to make that point, and I'll make some conclusions off of it here in a second. Go ahead, Mike.
So does that base... Just to draw the parallel between the Darwinian evolution and the physics. So he's saying in physics we have explanation of how, or excuse me, in biology we have the explanation of how things incrementally
could exist without a designer. Evolve. He thinks we wouldn't even grant that, but we go ahead.
Well, so what I'm questioning is just what you're saying. Are you saying that he is saying in physics you can't? So far, we don't have an explanation for how, like, the universe could exist with that one constant, and then eventually got to the next constant. Now we have all of them.
Yeah.
He's saying we have no idea how that could happen.
Yeah, he admits in his book we have no idea whatsoever how physics could be fine-tuned. He says we have a coping mechanism, an escape mechanism to explain how it happens within biology. We have that. We call it Darwinian evolution. But we have nothing that fits into physics that tells us how this could be fine-tuned. There's nothing at all. And so they feel kind of weak in physics. They admit they see fine-tuning all over the place within physics and in this universe. And they don't have a reason. And so when he gets to number 6, his final conclusion, we should not give up the hope of a better explanation arising in physics, something as powerful as Darwinism is for biology. What is that? That's a faith statement. That is entirely a faith statement. It's not even like our faith. Our faith is built upon history that God has revealed to us. His faith is a blind faith. He
He doesn't know if it'll ever will exist. He has no evidence of its existence, but he's decided to embrace it because this is a better alternative than embracing the concept of God. His faith is a much more precarious faith than ours. Our faith is built on solid things, the substance of what God has revealed to us, history, evidence, facts. His faith, he doesn't even have facts yet. But he's saying we hold out hope. That's a faith statement. That is a religion. There's no way that you get around it. And I make this statement. This is the Deus Ex Machina in reverse. And what basically we often get accused of is that when we were primitive in our society and everything else, we said God existed in the mountains. And when we finally climbed that mountain, we said God exists within the heavens. Basically, wherever we travel, we keep on pushing God further out, right? They said, oh, you don't really know God's there. And so this became known as Deus Ex Machina, God out of the machine, basically. That you don't understand how that machine functions? God did it. You know, we slap that label on everything. He's doing the same thing that he accuses us doing. We just hope there's going to be another answer. That's what science is, even though he has no even beginnings of an answer for this kind of thing. So I'm going a little long tonight, but I'll cover this last one or so. Here's another argument against design. This is something I've mentioned in church a few times. It's called directed panspermia. And this comes from the Scientific American blog. It's a guest blog, and it was published in 2013. Francis Crick, who discovered the structure of DNA with James Watson, and a guy named Leslie Orgel once proposed that life on Earth was the result of a deliberate infection designed by aliens who had purposely fed Mother Nature's seed to a new home in the sun. Crick repeatedly addressed the question of the origin of life between 1971 and 1988. This guy's working on his talking about this theory that they had during that time. Crick and Orgel proposed their directed panspermia theory at a conference on communication with extraterrestrial intelligence, the SETI project, more or less, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, organized by Carl Sagan and held at the Baikonur Observatory in Soviet Armenia in 1971. This theory, which they described as a highly unorthodox proposal and bold speculation, was presented as a plausible scientific hypothesis. 2 years after the conference, they published an article in Icarus in 1973. Crick and Orgel also suggested that the universe is sufficiently old that other intelligent civilizations could have arisen elsewhere. One of these other intelligent civilizations could have built a spaceship and seeded the universe with life. One can easily imagine a not-too-distant future where humans accept that our planet and all that lives within it will perish. In the unlikelihood that this is the only planet that harbors life in the universe, its demise would leave a lifeless universe. And he's talking about how wretched that is. How far have we gone, folks? So, before we even get to the next slide, what's the weakness? Evaluate the argument. And I know it's far-fetched, but there is a huge weakness here. He's trying to explain how things could exist without a designer.
It still doesn't disprove a designer.
Doesn't disprove a designer, but far worse.
Who created the aliens?
you get, you know, an internal regression of aliens, creating aliens upon aliens. Where did they come from? You know, those kind of things. You can't have it. And so this is a picture of the famous discoverer of deoxyribonucleic acid, DNA. And you've already noted, he appears to have discarded this hypothesis just from pure ridicule. He got laughed at quite a bit and finally gave it up. But there's been others that have picked it back up again, this whole directed panspermia. He's probably the most notable one. He actually has a Nobel Prize and several other honors. Very wealthy man. But it's just delaying the obvious. But how far will we go to deal with this whole thing of the fine-tuning of the universe and the fine-tuning of life? We'll go to great lengths. And if you think that the Discovery Channel and the History Channel sound kind of crazy and fluffy and you can't get your mind around some of the things that they're talking about, there's a reason for that. Because what they're talking about is not based in this world. They're going to such huge lengths to get around the idea of fine-tuning in the universe. Some teleology, some final thoughts here. The most plausible explanation for the fine-tuning of the universe is that there is a designer. And why do we avoid it so much? If we had to boil it right down to it, it's sin. and we go back once again to Aldous Huxley, Aldous, who is Darwin's bulldog, and he said, you know, I don't want to believe in a God because it would complicate my life of adultery. That's what it boils down to. We don't want God intervening and interfering in our affairs. And once again, based upon these arguments alone, we're left with a faceless deity. Who or what is the designer? These arguments are insufficient. They get us part of the way. I think we can substantiate that there is a God, but without God revealing himself in Scripture, we have never known certain aspects of who he is. Hebrews 1 talks about, in the times past, God spoke to us in many ways through the prophets, but in these last days, he's spoken to us in the Son, through whom he has created the entire world. We need that revelation. If Jesus hadn't died on the cross, we would not know that God was such a loving God. There'd be an entire aspect of his character and nature that would be missing. There's so much about God that he has to reveal to us directly and personally. We have to go beyond the arguments of science. I think they're good. I even think they're necessary so that we give God glory. And here's the shocking thing. We think these things are kind of profound and they're complicated and nuanced. The creation has been saying this all along, folks. It's been pouring forth speech day after day after day, and we're just so fallen. We're just finally catching up, and we're saying, this is what the universe has been saying all along. That's how hard the human heart is. And I hope that you've seen in the counter-arguments that we've explored, especially in these last two sessions, that the human heart is so hard, it will go to any length necessary to avoid the obvious, that there is a designer, that we're accountable to that designer, and we have an obligation to find out who he is. That's how we wrap things up tonight. Are there any questions, any statements, any thoughts as we bring things to a close and try to land the plane? I see no evidence from Scripture that aliens are real. I see, even though the entire universe is fine-tuned, the Earth then takes that fine-tuning to an entirely different level, right? You think about just the fine-tuning, not just in the universe with these cosmological constants, but then the fine-tuning of how far we are from the sun and photosynthesis and everything else. It's just so complex. Many of them impact each other. You remove one factor and you destroy all the others. The balance of life is delicate. And the only thing that we get out of the multiverse theory is that basically our universe is entirely improbable. There's just no way. You can create an infinite number of universes, and you hardly end up with any probable universes at all, even out of that equation. And so I think life is unique on Earth. And I think the Scriptures bear that out as well. Yeah. I took your question maybe too seriously. Sorry.
John 3:19-20, and this is the judgment. The light has come into the world, and people loved the darkness rather than the light because their works were evil.
Yeah.
For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his works should be exposed.
Yeah. And you think about those statements where they're saying, yeah, it looks like there's an appearance of fine-tuning in the universe, and it looks like that somebody is monkeyed with the cosmological constants, on and on and on, and then this is the result. They acknowledge the truth of it, and then they have to find some escape or coping mechanism. That's one of the most interesting things that we can do as laymen within science. Go looking for the coping or the escape mechanisms. The things in science that purely exist because they can't handle the idea of there being a creator, designer, God. There's an awful lot of them out there. Darwinian evolution just being one example. And the responses of the multiverses and the directed panspermia and all the other things being a few others, bubble universes, those kind of things. Yeah?
One thought, Mike's thought about this at work, is my grandma is actually into a cult called the Rancher Book to bring back the,
yeah,
alien thing, as goofy as it is. And that is heavily bringing back the thought that aliens, you know, seeded us, planted us on Earth. She's not the first person I've talked to. I continually run into people because of the History Channel, Discovery Channel, and we've got people like them that are continually pushing the alien thing.
Scientologists right there among them.
Right. They have no advance in evolution, so now this is kind of the thing that they're resorted to. Do you have any tips on effectively evangelizing those types of groups.
Yeah, I take them to Scripture directly, but I also I take this whole fine-tuning argument and play it and say, look how unique life is on this planet. Don't tell me it's everywhere. Don't make it. You know, none of the scientists are assuming that. They are, but they're doing it because they need life to exist elsewhere. When you look at the probability of it, and the guys that are honest. Life is highly improbable on any planet. And so I'd take a two-pronged approach. I definitely primarily use Scripture, but I'd use this as well. The universe of God proclaims his handiwork. And this brings into mind something I heard just recently, and I kind of at first balked at it, but I think I understand it now. R.C. Sproul asked his class, has God infallibly communicated in nature? What would your answer be to that? Has God infallibly communicated in nature? Okay, maybe it's because I asked it to you. Yes! You know, most people would say no, because they would say, but Scripture is higher than what we get revelation through nature, and so they would say no. But it is true that God, it's not how we perceive it. We're the messed up ones. It's not the sender, it's the receiver. We mess it up. We put our false understanding on it. But God is infallibly communicated in nature as well as in Scripture. Both of them, if we listen to truly how God has communicated, Romans 1:20 and everything else, God has communicated infallibly. So I think there are powerful things to be illustrated through nature. Scripture is paramount. We must use Scripture. That reveals an intimate, personal side of God that you will get nowhere else. But nature will not disagree. Nature will always be in concurrence with what comes from the Word. And it also has many powerful arguments that if people are listening to the speech of the universe, they will hear God speak. They will hear him speak. And he speaks infallibly through nature as well. And we still place Scripture, which is revealed in propositional truths, above observed truths within nature. Anything else? Okay. Nate, will you close us out in prayer this evening?
Heavenly Father, we thank you